hello there once again. You are listening to the Inspired Minds podcast. My name is Jeff Watson. As always, I am still gracious and grateful to be the host of this show. And you look fantastic. You truly, truly do. Hope you're doing well today, tonight, this evening, 4 a.m., wherever you are. I am doing quite well. I'm very happy because my good friend, Mr. Michael Lee Simpson, the producer of this little rock show that we have here, also just an old friend of mine, great, great guy. He has worked his hiney off to get a website up for this little shenanigan here. It's called inspiredmindspodcast.com. How's that for pretty simple stuff? The website's amazing. He's been working on it for quite some time, and I am elated. Hooray! It's up! So, he also told me that every single time, apparently, recently at least, there's been one particular city that is the first one to listen to the show. Every single time, the city of Baldwin, Missouri. Somebody out there in Baldwin, Missouri, or a couple of people in Baldwin, Missouri, just get the show immediately and listen to the sound of my rasping voice here. So I think that's fantastic. So I'm going to call out you wonderful people, whomever you are, in the lovely town of Baldwin, Missouri. And Baldwin, Missouri is a small-ish town, apparently about 31,103 of you. So somebody out there is listening to the sound of my voice. And I thought I'd do something similar that I usually do on the International High Five section, if you've been listening to this for a little bit. But in this particular case, I am going to play the national anthem of Missouri. Not the national anthem, for God's sakes, the state song of Missouri. What am I talking about? And it is absolutely fantastic. Check this out. It's lovely. A little country thing. Check this out.
Hush, you by my baby, summertime is coming soon.
Go figure. How lovely is that? Apparently Johnny Cash covered this song a long time ago as well. And obviously he should, because it's a great sound, it's a great state, and the fun thing about, a couple of things about this town, apparently you guys over there were named as one of America's best places to live by Money Magazine in 2005, 2011, and 2013. You got some catching up to do, apparently. A little bit of a gap there now, but that's okay. I think you're still fantastic, because it is this, so it's on Route 66, the famous Route 66 in America, which I have traveled a bunch. I may have even driven through Baldwin, come to think of it. But my favorite thing about Baldwin is that it was originally, it was founded by a guy named John Ball back in 1837. The original name was Balshow, Missouri. That didn't ring too well, apparently. So he changed it 2 days later to Baldwin. And the win, though, this is the best part, the win suffix meant precisely that, that to beat the older neighboring town of Manchester in prestige and growth. So it's kind of a nice little subtle fuck you out there to Manchester, whomever they were. And also, you guys over in Baldwin, Missouri have top-notch axe throwing. Axe throwing. That is both terrifying to me and completely awesome. Maybe I'll visit Baldwin. And if I do, perhaps I could be like a grand marshal of a parade. That's all I would ask. Maybe you can give me like kind of a music man kind of deal with like a, come on, what do you call it? Like a big stick or something. March back and forth with a stick. I don't even know what I'm talking about. How about put me on a float? That would be exciting for me. Probably not for anybody else there. So, Baldwin, Missouri, thanks for listening to me. You guys are good people. I appreciate it. And let's listen to a little bit more of the state song. Oh, it's lovely. Oh, I love this kind of stuff. Brings me back to my youth when I was listening to the old country with the family. And stop, because we're going to go into now the intro. We, the royal we, out of my mind tonight. This interview was also equally fun, wonderful, wonderful interview with the lovely and talented Kristen Lopez. And Kristen, she's a TV editor over at IndieWire, and she's also the creator of this thing called the Ticklish Business Podcast, which is a podcast that's solely devoted to classic pre-1970s Hollywood films. And that's kind of up my alley as well. There's just something so sweet and innocent about a lot of those films, especially the ones that are in black and white and back in the day. Just lovely, lovely sentiments in a lot of those. So we talked about that, of course. We talked about, she's been doing, experience, she's had experience working in entertainment journalism for over 15 years. And she's also disabled. So we talked a lot about disabilities. My client, I'm a caregiver for my part-time gig and to a wonderful disabled man. So we got a chance to talk about that. It's one of my passions as well. We talked about access, like wheelchair access in movie theaters, which is just really difficult and really basically not there. But we also talked about a lot of great representation of disabled people in films, such as the amazing Elephant Man, The King's Speech, Beautiful Mind, My Left Foot, which is kind of like the one. We also discussed the mighty Angeline, the incredibly iconic blonde woman from Los Angeles from the 80s, 90s, and 2000s. And we just had an absolutely fantastic conversation, as always. So, and as always, I hope that you enjoy this as much as I did making it, because I certainly did, ladies and gentlemen. Have a fantastic time, and go visit Baldwin. Just go visit Baldwin. I may do the same. Take care of yourselves. Bye. Hey, everybody. Inspired Minds audience. Guess who I have with me? The lovely and talented Kristen Lopez. Say hello, Kristen Lopez, to the Dazzle Throng.
Hello, everybody.
Man, I am excited to talk to you. I know I say that a lot on this show, folks, but my goodness. There's so many things I want to cover with you, but I always start the show off this way. I ask a standard question, and that is, Kristen, when you were young, what was the first thing that you can remember that inspired you when you were a child? Was it a song or a book or a poem, film?
Oh, gosh. I always tell people, you know, and it's a question that I often get when I get asked, like, why did you become a writer? And so I always point to the movie My Girl as the prime example of how I became. That movie holds a lot of commonalities with who I am as a person. I pretty much say that I became an English major because Griffin Dunn was gorgeous, and I thought all English teachers looked like him. That was a heinous lie.
Of course.
But I point to that movie as the film that kind of got me into becoming the person that I am. But now looking back on it, I think it also is a movie that fostered my love of movies and performers and writing. So it's a big cultural touchstone for me.
What about that movie? Look, I don't remember much. I remember that it was John Macaulay Culkin, and I remember that it was Anna Chlumsky. Is that right?
Yep. Yep.
And I know that someone dies.
Yes.
All right.
That's a very, very quick summation of the movie. All of that is true. So in terms of like commonalities to me, you know, a young girl who was a hypochondriac. I am well known in my family for being a hypochondriac. I'm not allowed to look at WebMD anymore because I usually diagnose myself with cancer at least once every couple of months. My best friend, who's still my best friend, is a boy, much like in the movie. The first like boy girl, non-romantic relationship I ever saw. The character in that, played by Anna Chlumsky, decides to become a writer, quote unquote, because she is in love with her teacher. And thus, I too became an English major who enjoyed writing purely because, again, erroneous assumption that English professors were all gorgeous. Not that I'm sure they aren't out there. It's just that I never met one. So yeah, a lot of just little things that I feel like the movie kind of set me on the path to being the great weirdo that I have now embraced. That is myself.
This is my favorite question. No, actually, I have two favorite questions to ask artists, and the second one's going to come at the end of the interview. It's another shtick that I do. But the thing I love about this question is because with creatives, especially, you can see the through line immediately.
Yeah, you know? I think that. It's definitely something that there's always a lodestone, you know, for lack of a better word. There's always something that they can pinpoint as this is something that set me off, whether that, like you said, is a movie or a song or a book. And I think it's also why we all have very like deep, fierce opinions about media. Not a day goes by where I don't see something on Twitter where they're like, what's the greatest song ever written? And people start arguing with each other in the comments. I think it's just media is one of those things where you can immediately pull it out and either come up with something that it inspired you to do or that you can remember the situation in which you saw it. If they're like, they're almost kind of like living records, you know, you can revisit them and you can remember, you know, who you saw it with, where you were, what maybe was going on that day. So, you know, I think that there's a deeper interest in media as memory in that regard, especially for creatives.
100%. And also, too, what you're really talking about is sense memory versus event memory, right? The things that are in front of you, those are event memory. The things that are sense memory last way outpace the event memory. So when you ask that question, or where people get asked that question, I'll ask myself that question sometimes. I remember where I was. I remember, like, I can remember vividly exactly where I was and what was going on at that exact same time and how I felt. So that's where that question always comes in with, like, my girls. Obviously, it meant something to her.
Exactly. That it did. For good and ill, I'm sure, as my mother will tell you.
Why couldn't you have liked Casino and been a gangster?
I mean, I did like that too. So, I mean, I was a very, you know, my parents were incredibly permissive when it came to film. So I saw Scorsese stuff at a very young age. I probably shouldn't have. But again, all cultivating the palette that would make me the writer that I am. So I guess, you know, thank you, Mom and Dad, for letting me watch R-rated movies probably when I shouldn't have been watching them.
Okay, I got to ask this question now because this just begs the next question. What was the most inappropriate R-rated film that you saw at a particular age, do you think? Because I can tell you mine. Mine was Sir Crazy. Sir Crazy was not a good idea.
I can tell you, I saw American Beauty when it came out. And I was, I think, 8 or 9. My mom and I, we go back and ask each other this, like, at least once a year. What was the impetus? Because she remembers that I asked her to go see it. My mother, you know, again, she's like, you know the difference between fantasy and reality, so I figured it wasn't a big deal. But I cannot tell you what was the inspiration for me to ask my mom to go see that. I just know that we did, and it was certainly probably something we should have vetted a little bit harder before we went and saw it. And I remember going to school the next day and telling my friend that I had seen it, and her mother was like, a lunch aide at the time. And when she heard that I had seen it, she was like horrified. She was like, your mother allowed you to go see this? My daughter only watches G movies. So it caused a bit of a kerfluffle. And we still to this day don't know what, if it was a commercial or if I just knew at the age of 8 years old that Sam Mendes was a great director. I don't really know. But that usually is the one I pinpoint is like, that probably should have waited a couple of years.
I watched Blade Runner at like 10. That wasn't a good idea, but it.
I mean, Blade Runner's not. I mean, as somebody who just saw Blade Runner for the first time this year, yeah, I know. Certain movies just escaped me. I mean, that's not that bad. I don't know. Maybe again, I would be a really permissive parent. I think and just be like, it's not. You know, it's.
Okay. So I went now here. Here we go with the questions, ladies and gentlemen. So you've been writing an extremely long time, about 15 years, right?
Yeah, give or take, out of high school.
So out of high school. So if I'm doing my math / Richard LinkedIn right, you were interning at Daily Wire or at IndieWire, no?
Yeah, so I got my first writing job out of high school at my senior prom, actually. A friend of mine, her boyfriend had read a Craigslist ad, which is probably the only time a Craigslist ad will yield any positivity. And he had read that the site was looking for movie reviewers. And I was like, oh, cool. You know, I can do that job. I made $10 a review, which for me was like big money out of high school. I was like, oh, that pays for my movie tickets because I was going to the movies all the time. And so I did that. And then along the way, IndieWire, when they were owned by a different company, was doing like an internship. And I applied for it and I got it. And internship was kind of like a loose word for saying like kind of like a permalancer. You know, they were just going to have you come up with stuff that the other writers didn't really have time to do. So I did a lot for, you know, coming up with like film previews and putting all the reviews into Rotten Tomatoes. And I did that for about a year But because I didn't live in LA, they were like, well, we don't really know what to do with you. You can keep working for us, you know, and interning. But at the time I was like, I'm going to college, you know, I kind of need money. So I gave it up. And so when I got the job with them again, 2 years ago, one of the first things I said was I was an intern for an unpaid intern for you guys back, back in the day, which was really cool. So I toiled for a very long time, working for people that, you know, just kind of gave me a little cash that, thankfully paid for my movie tickets until like 3D and the price of tickets went up. And then I wasn't getting a raise from the site I was reviewing. So I was kind of losing money by the time I left them.
And you've been writing, I mean, my God, who do you not write for at this point? National Geographic?
I joke that the only place I have not ever been published in is Vanity Fair yet. Fingers crossed. Yes.
And you seem to, I mean, obviously, well, I shouldn't say obviously, for me at least, you focus on entertainment. I do see that. But the thing I liked about your writing and the thing I'm excited to talk to you more about is that you write about larger themes within the film. Perfect example of this, I will pull this up because I thought this was really cool. You did this really good article on Hereditary, but it wasn't just the review of the movie per se, which I thought was brilliant, but it was also because you talked about, you tied it into the virgin suicides. You talked about the, like, that maternal protectiveness that manifests through grief. And I thought that was fantastic. And if I could be a super dork again, you did it again with the legend of Tarzan and the magic Mike connection about tapping into women's yearning for body. It just really impressive. So you're not the standard writer. So tell me about that.
Yeah. I mean, I always feel that entertainment, as much as we love it, it's hard to be original nowadays. You know, movie making has been a thing for over 100 years. So, you know, and they, you know, they joke that what, there's only 5 stories that, you know, movies can work with. So I'm a fan of finding connections where there aren't necessarily connections to be made. So like I did a lot of articles kind of looking at certain movies, harkening back to classic film. You know, like I wrote something about Ocean's 8 when that came out and how it was very similar to screwball comedies. Mm-hmm. Or when Free Fire came out and I talked about, you know, the women of the 1970s and how that film kind of connected with that. Because I feel like as somebody who loves classic Hollywood, you know, pre-1970s films, I feel like there's this belief, this misguided belief that these movies are victims of their time. They're dated, they're boring. Who would want to watch something that's in black and white? A lot of the work that I do is hopefully inspiring other people to check out some of these movies. You know, like Martin Scorsese has a list of classic films he loves that's a mile long. Quentin Tarantino, like the great directors, all love these movies. And there's a reason for that. So I try to do that. And I also try to, you know, connect movies to themes that maybe they're not really thinking of. You know, I do this a lot with like disability too, you know, like Pixar movies, great examples of like disability narratives, if you really think about them, and the concept of like outsiders and difference. X-Men's a great example. There's a reason that when X-Men came out, you know, they were connected, being connected to like LGBTQ representation. So I always try to, you know, look at movies from an angle of like, everything old is new again. The things you love now were once popular. You know, film is a you know, medium that peaks and crests and has cycles that we all love. Like, if you love this, hopefully it will compel you to check out something else. I'm all for creating a rabbit hole.
I have to ask, because I agree with you on the old Hollywood thing. It's what I also wanted to talk to you about your Ticklish Business podcast, right? And I love old Hollywood films. I don't know as much as I probably want to, quite frankly. I mean, I really, really wish I would. I'm more of a 70s Scorsese, you know, that kind of person. But there's something about it that is just so innocent and beautiful, and the dancing. And it's just such for me, it's an antidote. Whenever I do go back to it, to like TCM or any of those online, it's an antidote to what's going on for me.
Yeah, it's definitely something that the longer we've been doing the podcast, the more I'm always surprised by how many myths I can kind of debunk. You know, we just did an episode where we were talking about, you know, sexiness. Like, one of the big things that I always hear is like, oh, classic films, they're not sexy, and the women were all wives and mothers. And I'm like, well, you're watching the wrong movies, because some of them are really sexy, and the women are really compelling. You know, some of these movies. Exactly. You know, I talk about, like, people always say, oh, disability representation's gotten better. Actually, it really hasn't. You know, if you look back at, like, the classic film era, Todd Browning's 1932 film Freaks is still one of the few movies to have a predominantly disabled cast. So, you know, I think there's a lot of history, and yes, we can look at the progress we've made as you know, media has progressed, but I think we also can use classic film to look at how things haven't changed, and, you know, the ways that you can still find unique areas of expertise in a format that many assume is just kind of beginning. So therefore there was nothing, you know, we've obviously progressed. Well, in some cases we haven't.
Yeah. Because as I mentioned earlier, before we started recording, I worked with a disabled gentleman. I should say I had the honor of working with this crazy guy. I love him to death. He's like my brother at this point. Beautiful human being. My God. But it's interesting. I bring him up because this is a good segue into something I want to talk about specifically. I read somewhere that in addition to all the things that you were working on, that you have a passion not only for disabled rights, but also wheelchair access in theaters?
Mm-hmm.
That is so critical.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because here's the deal. And I want to ask you about this, but my guy and I go to a movie every week. That's our thing, you know? And he's in a wheelchair, and it's not easy.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, I use a wheelchair myself. So I've always complained about access in movie theaters. You know, the math never adds up to me. You know, I'm like, okay, well, I can't access 99% of a standard movie theater, and yet I'm supposed to be happy with the, you know, 1% that I get, which everybody else can access if they want, you know? So it was always something that I was very irritated by. And as I've grown to have the platform that I have, and I'm, you know, considered one of the few, if not the only, as far as I know, somebody can correct me, physically disabled journalists at a trade level. You know, I always just felt it was my responsibility to kind of point out some of these things, because my hope is that, you know, in 5, 10, 15 years, I'm not the only one doing this. I should not be the only one doing this. And at the same time, you know, there's a lot of, I get emails from a lot of, like, young kids who were like, I Googled disabled journalist and your name came up. How do I get to be you? And I'm like, well, get ready to send a lot of angry emails to people, because it's kind of sucky. But I mean, it's, a lot of it is, you know, people don't know what they don't know. And when it comes to disability, unless you know somebody, in many instances, you're not even thinking about it. So, you know, writing an article about, you know, FYC for your consideration season, and the numerous invitations I got from, you know, people saying, oh, we want you to come to this Emmys event. It's in a historic building, or it's in somebody's private house, and having to explain to them, like, well, okay, but what are you going to do for access for disabled, you know, attendees? And their response is, well, you know, we have big burly guys that can carry you.
God,
you know, and a lot of why I write about that stuff, you know, people are like, oh, it's first world problems. You know, you're talking about journalistic stuff that only, you know, certain people are going to deal with. I'm like, yeah, but it trickles down to anytime, you know, somebody in a wheelchair wants to go to a party and has to have that awkward conversation with a friend and have them be like, well, you know, we can carry you into the building. Like, it's about kind of promoting this concept of, like, we need to be more aware of people's, like, personal dignity in these situations, and try to, you know, not make it a big embarrassing thing by pointing out, like, these are issues, so that next time, you know, you're planning something, maybe start thinking about somebody that doesn't look like you, and the logistics there.
Yeah, you're educating. You're Johnny Appleseed, the way I see it. You know? Right?
It's interesting to me, because it's something I did not want to do for a very long time. You know, the concept of educating people, I was like, that's not my job. That's why I'm not a teacher. That's why I didn't become a teacher, because I don't want to do that. And as I've gotten older and realized that, like, part of it is, you know, the capitalistic element. Like, nobody's right about disability. If anybody's going to profit off of it, it should be me, right? But also, I mean, as I started doing it more and more, I realized that, like, there is a deeper element of, like, oh, people want to read about disability stories from somebody who actually understands. You know, I've been fortunate to do a few interviews with disabled creatives or actors, and they're like, I don't have to explain the language to you. Like, I don't have to explain to you why you shouldn't refer to me as wheelchair bound, or why, you know, there's an ease and a comfort from somebody being able to sit down and have me interview them, and they're not, you know, going to be embarrassed to say something, or, you know, like, so I get it, which has been really gratifying.
Yeah, it's amazing what, because I'm the same way. I'm bipolar. So I feel like I have to educate. I had the same thing. I was like, I don't want to educate anybody about this. But then once I understood that the education brings power and understanding and agency for both them and me, then I'm able to, I'm proud to be able to do that. That's just been my experience, right? I do want to ask you actually about I'm going to go somewhere else with this. I have some movies that I wrote down about disabilities, and I want to kind of bounce them off you and see where this goes.
Sure.
It's going to be interesting.
Yeah.
First of all, for bipolar, I realized that movie Silver Lining Playbooks nailed it for me. I wasn't manic. I didn't have the presentation of bipolar when I saw the movie, and it wasn't until years later that I had it and went back and watched it, and I was like, oh my God, that's it. That's mania.
That I have an issue with that as a film, not necessarily from the mental health angle, but that is one of the few David O. Russell movies that I really didn't like when I saw it. And I haven't revisited it since. I think mostly because I feel like David O. Russell sometimes either gets female characters or he really doesn't. So I remember not being impressed by Jennifer Lawrence's character, the way she was written. But keep in mind, I have not revisited it since it came out. Maybe now that I'm older and wiser, it will feel different for me.
It's a good representation because the way that, what was his name? The actor.
Bradley Cooper.
The way he played it was just so perfect, because when you're manic, it's like being on methamphetamine. It's really interesting. People think you're on meth. I tell my friends, it's been a long time since I've had any issues with that, and medication and therapy, et cetera. But it's like being on free meth. It's really fascinating. So that everything, you're doing a billion different things and you got a million ideas and you never sleep. And it's just such an odd disorder. Okay. Next one. This is really important for me because as a kid, I stuttered so, so badly. And I had so much shame as a result for so long. The King's Speech.
Oh. I remember, again, this is a movie that I have not revisited since it came out. I remember liking it. I think that the biggest issue I always have, and it's an issue that is chronic with most disability representations, is that Colin Firth does not have a stutter in real life.
True.
And while he did a lot of really great research, and I know a lot of people that say that he really captured the struggle of being a stutterer, I was still like, yeah, but, I mean, come on, we couldn't have found like one actor that had maybe like a tangential connection there. But I remember really liking it and really feeling like it did capture the inherent discomfort that comes from like having something to say. And I mean, if you broaden it out to other disabilities, I mean, isn't that really most disability narratives too? Like the concept of wanting to be understood and literally not. So I remember really being impressed by it when it came out.
Which then goes to the final one for me. And again, I just thought about this like 30 minutes ago. So like, I think this is it. The Elephant Man. The Elephant Man is absolutely my favorite movie about a disability.
Oh my gosh. So this is one that I'm going to rewatch because I remember watching it probably about 7 or 8 years ago and just being blown away by it. I mean, the effects for starters are really, really interesting, but it really does. I've written about before, and I've taken flack for it, but I stand by it. I write a lot about what I term quote unquote pretty disabilities, which are essentially Hollywood's way of casting some hot person to play a disabled person because there's no physical you know, change, which is why you get, you know, like a lot of, you know, blind women or deaf or nonverbal, you know, things where the actor who usually is not disabled does not have to make any type of physical change to their person. And I think that what The Elephant Man gets right, and I wish that more studios had embraced it when it came out, is that certain disabilities, I mean, you can't hide them. Much like in The Elephant Man, it goes back to Freaks, you know, from 1932. Huh. Those are disabilities that tend to be far more common, you know, like for me, you know, my disability, I am very short, very compact. My body is not physically this, you know, aesthetically the same as everybody else's. And you know, growing up as a kid, like that really screws you up because yeah. You're like, I have no concept of like what is supposed to be normal for me. What does dating look like when you're, you know, a short girl that is not like aesthetically, you know, got a waist and like, you know, so there's a lot of questions. And I think that that's what I really appreciate about The Elephant Man. And I wish that more studios had seen that movie's success and beauty and humanity and used that to tell more stories. I know that this is a tangent, but it's one of my favorite Hollywood stories that Jodie Foster for a long time was trying to make a story about a circus performer named Flora Plum. Google her. She's a really fascinating character who was essentially, they would have called her like not like a bearded woman, but she had hair all over her body. Kind of like what they did with Fur, the Robert Downey Jr. film. Yeah. But she was a woman that was in the circus and she had an overabundance of hair. And, you know, Jodie Foster wanted to tell this story about the struggles of being a, you know, disabled woman with this type of situation. I think she had like Hugh Jackman or Russell Crowe attached at one point to be like the love interest because there was going to be a love interest, which again would have been really cool. And the movie never got made, unfortunately. It was very sad. But I do champion stuff like The Elephant Man, because I think that that is more of what we need and less of like me before you, you know, stories about like white disabled guys who like live in mansions and their biggest issue in life is they don't know what to spend their money on and they, you know, can't get the girl or something, even though they can get the girl. But like the movie says, no, they're disabled. They can't get the girl. So I would like more Elephant Mans and less whatever that movie with Bryan Cranston was.
The thing about The Elephant Man that I really love so much, and I saw it again, actually, just kind of about 6 months ago in light of working with my friend, my guy. And there's that feeling I learned early on with working with this gentleman that autonomy is God, especially for him. Because he has no short-term memory and he's been told all of his life, you can't, you know. He couldn't talk for 2 years. It was just, you know, all of his life he's been told no. And he's 43, which unfortunately he doesn't really remember sometimes. And it's extraordinarily important for him to feel agency, which I completely understand. And so when I watched The Elephant Man with that in light, there's that great line when he says, this heartbreaking line, I am not a man, or sorry, I am not an animal, I am a human being. And it was just such a seminal point in that film, and it really resonated with me all of a sudden because I'm like, oh my God, of course he wants dignity. Of course he wants to be in a tuxedo with society and not focus just on his disability.
Exactly. And I think that that's what people are really trying to push in the industry is less a focus on quote unquote disabled narratives and more just about characters that happen to be disabled. You know, the big question that a lot of actors I hear talk about is like, why is this character able-bodied? What makes that character have to be able-bodied? Why can't that person be in a wheelchair? Why can't that person be an amputee? You know, this is just the film that popped into my head. You know, Greta Gerwig's doing Barbie. Why can't there be, I mean, there is a disabled Barbie doll. I mean, why is that one of the characters not disabled? So I think that's what people are really pushing for in the industry at this point. But I think the sad fact is that it's still very much a movement in its infancy. You know, again, the predominant narrative for disability in film is a white male who is disabled late in life, you know, and usually is financially successful. And all of those things are not at all the statistics of most disabled people living in America.
Would you put Beautiful Mind in that category with the schizophrenia with Russell Crowe?
You know, I delineate. So, and this is not something that every disabled person does. I tend to delineate disability and mental illness into separate categories, because I think those films, there's different tropes and stereotypes for each. But yes, I mean, A Beautiful Mind, I think, is a great example too. Again, you know, white male, upwardly mobile. When you see women who are maybe schizophrenic or bipolar in cinema, historically, you know, they're presented as quote unquote crazy, you know, or it's something that limits their relationships. And thus, you know, there's far more exaggeration and camp to it than I think something like A Beautiful Mind, where it's like, oh, the tortured genius, you know, a man with mental illness in movies. Is somebody who is like, oh, why can't I just get through to him? You know, like, but at the same time, they hold a lot of commonalities. A Beautiful Mind and even something like, you know, again, to use Me Before You, are stories about, you know, able-bodied women, and neuro, you know, mentally sound women trying to, you know, provide love as a means of helping this man overcome, which, you know, kind of like, Do we really though? Like, you know, disabled women. I don't see a movie with a disabled woman who's like, where's my hot dude? Where's Channing Tatum telling me how to overcome, my disability? Like, that doesn't happen.
No, it doesn't.
No, it does not. No. And I think there's I have theories for why that is. And I think that Hollywood is very, very clear about why certain things just are not on their radar.
Well, what's one of your theories? Give me one of your theories.
So I tend to say that, you know, women, disabled women don't show up in movies. Let me clarify. If a disabled woman does show up in a movie, she has, a pretty disability. So she is maybe deaf or blind or nonverbal. So that you can have, you know, your Margot Robbies, or you can have a hot girl play that. You know, movies where you don't get movies where a woman is physically disabled, you know, like in a wheelchair, let alone, you know, even if a woman is in a wheelchair, you know, I'm a big fan of the Child's Play series and Curse of Chucky and Cult of Chucky both have an actress. Fiona Dourif is not disabled, but I maintain those are one of the better disabled narratives because she is in a wheelchair, and you do get to see the physical element to being a wheelchair user. But again, she's still, you know, 5'6" or whatever. She is aesthetically normal looking in her body. And I think a lot of that is, you know, to use a crass term, you know, the belief is that disabled women are not fuckable. You know, so men are not going to want to date that, which is, again, a lie.
Yeah.
But I think that Hollywood still kind of says, like, men, you know, as we've seen with, like, the King of Queens mentality, you know, like, women will put aside looks for a dude, you know. Yeah. Like, you can get a disabled guy because, like, Bryan Cranston's character in that movie has money, or Sam Claflin in Me Before You, his character has money. So a woman is going to put aside the wheelchair. Women, the belief in Hollywood is that, like, guy's not going to look past, you know, like the wheelchair girl, you know, or your facial scar, or yeah, that, you know, crazy birthmark on your face. Like, guy's not going to see past that. So we have to make you, you know, blind or deaf, you know, so that the guy can help you again overcome. I mean, to use an example, Children of a Lesser God, the story, the film, not the reality, the harsh reality of the relationship between Marley Matlin and William Hurt. But even in that movie, you know, it's very much a teacher student type of thing where he has to help her become a normal member of society within her deafness. So it's really interesting and sometimes very anger inducing to, you know, kind of look at how women, disabled women in media are portrayed. Cause I'm like, well, that's why I'm in therapy, because movies taught me that, like, women that look like me, we just don't exist. You know, like, we're hiding in the shadows because, you know, nobody's going to look past our clear issues.
No, you know, going back to what you were saying earlier, essentially representation matters, duh. So when you were saying things like you get people Googling you and saying you're a disabled journalist and they come to you, that's amazing because you are now representing them.
Exactly. And it's very weird to me. It's very surreal that like people think I'm cool, but mostly that people think I am successful and interesting in that way. But it's a lot of responsibility for sure.
Yeah, I'd imagine. I would imagine. Oh, one last film I got to give a little shout out to is kind of the number one for me, My Left Foot.
Very true. I tell people all the time, because that tends to be the one that I get asked about a lot. Oh, what do you think about My Left Foot? And I always say I'm normally, most instances, I'm against able-bodied actors playing physically disabled, you know, characters. Sure. But to read about what Daniel Day-Lewis did in preparation for that, in terms of like, he lived in that wheelchair and like lived in that body, you know, even after the cameras were off, you know, he lived it for the entire time he filmed it. And I really appreciate that because I mean, I have no basis to whether this is true or not. I would hope that it had, you know, kind of taught him to be a bit more, you know, aware of disability. You know, most actors don't do that. You know, when Jake Gyllenhaal plays a guy in a wheelchair, you know, they say cut. Like, I'm sure he got up out of the wheelchair and went about his day. Yeah. So I applaud Daniel Day-Lewis for kind of committing to that and at least trying to show that, like, it's not something you can kind of put on and off. You have to, you know, you're it. You have to fully inhabit it. And if you aren't, then it's still a performance.
No one can say he's not method.
Very true. Actually, one of the few method actors that I've you know, is not a jerk about being method.
No, but I got to tell you this. You probably know this. This is your Hollywood lore as well. But I read a story where apparently Daniel Day-Lewis and Sally Field, when they were doing Lincoln, they were both method, right? So they would apparently text each other back and forth at night when they were in the hotels or whatever. And they would text back and forth of like, this infernal machine, I do not know how to work this. Can you believe what's happening on the front? Like they were in character, even texting. That's amazing.
I love those stories.
Oh, it's so good. And I guess when he filmed There Will Be Blood, you know, while the rest of the crew is having the hotel out in the middle of the desert somewhere, he's like, I must have a tent and I must have, you know, meat. And that was it. I'll be out here for a week. All right. Actually, wait. My favorite method story, and then we'll move on, is please tell me you know the Dustin Hoffman, Sir Laurence Olivier method man or marathon man story.
Yes, I have heard that.
That's a legend. My son, it's called acting.
It's a great example. You know, anytime I hear about like, you know, somebody using method as an excuse to be horrible, I always say like, well, Larry Olivier must have had it right.
Yeah, that's exactly my favorite story about method ever. Dustin just running around a block or whatever it was, and just shoot, what's wrong with you? I'm trying to get in the character. Oh, Dustin, it's called acting. So here's a question. I'm genuinely curious, and I didn't see it anywhere. Is there any screenwriting thing in the world for you? Do you consider do that?
You know, when I moved to LA, that was the joke that my mom and I had was, you know, everybody in LA has a script. Everybody, you know, it talks about having a script. And it was never something that I wanted to do just because I didn't feel like I had the tools for that. You know, I'm like, and then I would hear from friends all the time, like, your stories about your childhood are really funny. You know, everything is funny. And I'm like, you call it funny. I call it true. You know, so it's been something I've been dabbling very, very just kind of in my free time. You know, so I don't know. I think that, you know, now that I've lived in LA long enough, I'm kind of like open to trying anything and kind of seeing what happens. But no definitive plans. It's just kind of something where I'm like, I might as well play around with ideas, you know, and see what happens.
Can I be your cheerleader for a second?
Sure.
Let me get the pom-poms. Hang tight. So here's the deal. You're obviously a great writer because you speak like a great writer. That's the hallmark of a good writer, is they speak like one. So you got that in your corner. Second of all, you know films better than anybody else I've ever spoken to so far, including me, which is terrifying. Also, you understand narrative arc. I noticed that. you can pull out a theme out of a movie in about 3 seconds, I think. And that, with along with a copy of Final Draft, you're off to the races. You could do a good job. You're a good storyteller.
Yeah, I've been.
You are. That's what you are.
Thank you. Yeah, it's been a. It's been something. Yeah, I've been dabbling in. You know, so maybe down the line. I mean, I'm a person that creates way too many projects, and then I'm like, why did I craft so many projects? So it's definitely one of many projects. So hopefully, you know, down the line, I'll have some news maybe on that front in the future. Who knows?
You've got some, like I said, you've got the gift of gab, you've got the gift of narrative thought, you've got the gift of abstract thought, and you've got the gift of transparency, obviously. And those kind of things, and you understand what a good movie is and isn't, I think you're good. Which leads me into another one. I want to maybe close this out with this kind of thing, because I want to go knock some films down that you like. We'll see where we go. Dead Ringers, go.
It's my favorite movie, one of my favorite movies. It is great body horror. It's a blisteringly sad story about addiction, and there's two Jeremy Irons. Who doesn't want two? I mean, that's great. So yeah, it's definitely my favorite. Although I have way too many thoughts about like Jeremy Irons wearing jeans and eating pizza. I don't believe that that's a thing that he does in reality.
I forgot.
I love it though.
It's one of my all-time favorite movies, but Jesus Christ, you're right. What a searing.
Yeah.
Like, of all people, Cronenberg knows how to stage a shot, too, and that should not have happened.
I mean, it's something that I joke, like, I'm like, I don't believe he knows what pizza is. I think that, like, he lives off of, like, food from the 1600s or something. Like,
Nectar
I
just feel like he.
Exactly. I have been told, though, that he does know what pizza is. He does wear jeans in his free time, and I'm like, nope. Nope, that's not true.
not
I was fortunate. I talked to, I interviewed Geneviève Bujold, who is the girl in the movie, a couple years ago, because I love her. And I told her that I saw Dead Ringers as a kid, and she was just, like, impressed and also embarrassed. She was like, you should not have been watching that as a child. I'm like, well, it happened.
It happened.
And I love it, so.
No, that's, I mean, that classic scene when they're in red, when they're in the surgeon room.
Yeah.
God.
Yeah.
Okay.
And again, as a disabled person, like who's been in like surgical settings, like it's horror on a different level. If you've been in situations where you're like medical professionals are terrifying.
Yeah. I didn't think of it that way. You're absolutely
right. I tend to freak out about medical stuff, like regardless. So yeah, I think that if you're anybody that's had like surgery on you, performed on you, like it hits you in a different way.
You're out. okay, Primal Fear, go.
Oh my gosh! Great procedural. Edward Norton's in fine form.
Yep.
It is a movie that I still don't understand the appeal of Richard Gere. I missed the 80s. I didn't get him. But it's a great, like, we don't get, when people talk about like adult movies and not like porn, but like movies aimed at adults. Yeah. It's a movie I always point to. It's like, this is what just a really good movie. Like when you know you're an adult and you're like, I just want to watch good actors act good.
Okay, last and final, because of you and reading research, I found out there's a new Spinal Tap coming out?
Apparently, yes, there's going to be a sequel, which is shocking to me.
My God, yeah. I can't wait.
I don't know how I feel about it, but I love the original so much that I will blindly follow Rob Reiner and crew wherever they go.
Oh, I'm a giant. I mean, all of those movies I just love. My favorite actually is A Mighty Wind about the folk music.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Oh, my God. That movie's so wonderful. The thing about their films is that they have such heart in them, even though they're just chaotic and odd. I could go on for days about his films. But to wrap this little show up, actually, I wanted to ask you about something. This is the one thing I really thought was interesting. You apparently operated a cash register during an annual book fair for like 4 years, right?
I did, yeah.
Why?
So I did it in middle school through high school. And I just really loved books. And it was great volunteering experience. So it was definitely, it was something I did mostly that I, so I could have an excuse to be like, well, I worked and now I need to go buy books because there are books around me. So, you know, some people might consider that a way to, you know, addict behavior in terms of like, well, you put yourself in a situation where you have to like indulge your addiction. Exactly. So I did it. And it was great.
The reason I brought this up to close this out, I thought that was just absolutely wonderful because it speaks volumes about the woman that I really got. I really enjoyed this conversation because the thing that's such a great thing about that, at least for me, is you were doing what you loved. You were around in the environment, you were around books, and you were giving your time freely away. So you almost had these twin stars, you know, of service work and being involved in what you love.
Exactly. I did not think of it that way. But I mean, it was, especially, you know, when you're a teenager and, you know, there's not a whole lot with a wheelchair that like people will let you do because, you know, you have liability written all over your forehead.
Yeah.
You know, it was something that was great for me to, you know, feel like, oh, okay, like every normal teenager, I had to volunteer. This is something that I could do that I genuinely like wanted to be at. So thank you, Breen Elementary Book Fair, for letting me hang out with you guys for several years, probably more than I should have.
I'm sure they were just as pleased to have you. Thank you so much for doing this. My God, what a good human being you are.
Oh, anytime, anytime. It was so much fun.
Excellent. Well, we're going to do a little thing here where we pretend to say goodbye. I'm going to quote unquote hang up and we'll chat for about 2 more seconds and then we're good. So here comes the acting involved. Kristen, thank you so much for doing the show. I really did have a good time. I enjoyed, by the way, talking about The Elephant Man. That was a fantastic. Oh, and also too, I could do an entire hour on After Hours with Griffin Dunn. So that's,
I am a weirdo that likes, you know, can go long on Scorsese movies, rock docs. I mean, I know way too much about so many things. So anytime I'm available.
We need to be BFF soon. Okay. I'm going to do the pretend click hang up here. Ready? 1, 2, click.